Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, there is a Bible study led by Mark Pellet, who will be teaching on warning, disciple beware of gardens, based on Mark chapter 13. So let's listen in on Michael.
In the last session, we were looking at chapter 10, which was Jesus' third passion prediction, and the disciples' misunderstanding that they still want to be the greatest. And here it was particularly James and John who misunderstood because of that sense of authority and what they wanted as authority and how they understood that in terms of power, right? About, but we have the power, will we be in charge? Can we control things? And that was the understanding that that was not Jesus' sense of discipleship.
Oh, thank you.
That he wanted something else, something different. And so again, in Mark's typical way, he helps us to understand that the true sense of discipleship is not personified by any of the 12, but by someone who's outside the 12.
This is much nicer.
Blind Bartimaeus. And so we didn't get to blind Bart on Wednesday, and I want to spend a little time today talking about this because it's so important, I think, in Mark's gospel, because blind Bartimaeus, for Mark, kind of exhibits the ideal of discipleship. In other words, Bartimaeus does all the things that the 12 don't do. Right, so Bartimaeus is our positive example about discipleship. We read in verse 46 of chapter 10, they came to Jericho, and as Jesus and his disciples and a large crowd were leaving Jericho, Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, a blind beggar, was sitting by the roadside. Okay? By the roadside. Now again, that seems to be kind of a detail that really wouldn't be that important or significant. It's kind of, well, where else would you expect blind beggars to sit? But I think in Mark's gospel, that's an important detail because, again, if you remember back to the parable of the sower and the seed, the first place that the seed falls in that parable is where? By the roadside, on the path side. So just to reiterate, right, that's where the seed falls, and the seed that falls by the roadside is what? Right, in some sense, it's the worst possible place that seed could fall, right? If you want something to grow, if I'm going to go out and sow some seed here, the worst possible place that seed would grow is if I'd sow it right by the side of the road here, right? All that packed dirt, gravel, whatnot, it's not going to grow by the word, right? So again, there's blind Bart by the roadside. The worst possible place in terms of our expectations are nothing's going to happen there, right? I mean, plus, by the roadside, again, remember to heighten this, old Bart is a blind beggar, right? By the roadside, and I think back then, just as now, I mean, usually as you're driving along, what do you see by the roadside? Trash.
That's right.
And so, of course, as you're walking along through Jericho, I mean, what are you going to see on the side of the road? Trash. And of course, isn't that what blind beggars are? Trash. Right? I mean, they're that in their system, they're that in our system. right? The way we think about those. These are the refuse of society. So of course, right, we've got the worst possible place for seed, and on top of it, there's trash, right? The kind of thing, what fruitfulness could possibly come out of here? And yet this is the place where we're going to find the ideal of what it means to be a disciple. Just think about that. The worst possible place for fruitfulness, right? The trash of society is that possibility. You put those two together, right? The probabilities would seem almost zero for anything to happen, and yet it's there where the ideal of discipleship happens. Remember, earlier in chapter 10, Jesus had told us that for mortals, this would not be possible. But for God, all things are possible. Worst possible place, if you will, worst possible person, for God, that's not an impossibility to get the best possible disciple. The radicality of God's power, of God's word, of discipleship in action. I mean, just by the setting already, Mark is graphically painting this picture of discipleship and what that's all about. Okay, verse 47. There's old Bart there, side of the road, trash of society that he is. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout out and say, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Okay, again. Bartimaeus exhibits the, if you will, the proper logic of discipleship. He hears that it is Jesus, which again means that what? Right? This old blind beggar sitting by the side of the road is listening. He knows what to listen to. Again, you think, by the side of the road, there's probably all sorts of voices and noises and things that go past him day after day. But hearing Jesus, or hearing about Jesus, leads him to speak. And not just speak, but shout, insistently knowing what to say because he knows what to listen to. That listening, again, evokes the shouting. And in this case, the shouting, one could almost say, is in terms of a prayer. This one who hears also knows what to say. Contrast him to James and John. James and John come along and say, "Jesus, we want you to do for us whatever we ask you." Bartimaeus says, "Jesus, have mercy on me." Right? The prayer of the disciple is a prayer for mercy, is a prayer for God's graciousness, is a prayer for God's unconditional love to be at work. It's not the arrogance, it's not the haughtiness, it's not the self-centeredness of authority, power. Do whatever we want you to do. As though, again, Jesus and God is the ones that we manipulate and control, and they're at our beck and call. The discipleship that asks for mercy, that asks for God's graciousness to be at work in the world. Now to make... verse 48. Many sternly ordered him to be quiet. Okay, again, that sternly ordered is the word rebuke. Just like we had in Mark chapter 8, when Peter rebuked Jesus, when Jesus said, "Oh, look at the, you know, I as the Messiah must go to Jerusalem, suffer, die," and all that. And Peter rebukes Jesus, right? Chews him out and says, "No, none of that." And Jesus then rebukes Peter and says, "Get behind me, Satan." Now there are those in the crowd that rebuke Bartimaeus and say, "Be quiet." Which again, here I'm reading from the New Revised Standard Version, and that's far too polite. Right. I mean, they're telling him, "Shut up!" Right? Or at times, if the Pope gets angry, right, as some of his priests and bishops and theologians in Latin America, he says, "Silencio!" Right? I mean, that's, you know, shut up, be silent. You know, it's not, "Would you be quiet, please?" I mean, the stakes are much higher. They're telling, you know, silence. And again, the irony is the kind of thing, this shut up, this be silent. The word used for that was the word that Jesus used when the demons would say, "We know who you are." And Jesus would say, "Be silent, shut up." And so the irony here again is that what? This kind of rebuke and command that Jesus uses on the demonic, those who are not followers of Jesus use that kind of rebuke and command on followers of Jesus. And want, right? And in that sense, want us to shut up. The world, what does the world have to say to followers of Jesus? "Be silent. Shut up. Don't say anything. Stop talking like that." And what would be the response of a faithful disciple? "But he cried out even more loudly." Oh, man. The world, right? I mean, the world is shouting, "Shut up," and we shout even more loudly. Right? Jesus is the Christ, and the way of the cross is the way of life. Right? Again, you see the conflict there, the conflict that's involved in that conversation. And the conflict is that at that point, the disciples, having heard who Jesus is, can speak clearly and loudly in the voice of conflict. Amidst all that din and uproar and clamor, there can be that clear voice, right? A clear voice of mercy coming through. When all of that happens, what? Verse 49, "Jesus stood still and said, 'Call him here.' And they called the blind man, saying to him, 'Take heart, get up, he is calling you.'" Note there again how the word "call" or "calling" is used three times in just that short sequence. Here I think a parallel to note back in chapter 3, there was the calling of the disciples, and Jesus calls the 12. Here we've got Jesus once again calling a disciple. Again, Bartimaeus is mentioned by name, and even that understanding that like Peter and others who had the surname, it's Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. Kind of like a formal calling ceremony, right? Because his name is given. I mean, we're not given the names often of other people that Jesus heals, right? I mean, like Jesus heals a blind man, Jesus heals a deaf mute, Jesus heals an epileptic boy, but we're just given, but here again, the name. And most of the time when names are given in Mark, it's a connection with discipleship. So we get this sense again, Bartimaeus is being called as a disciple. So of course, being called, verse 50, throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. Then Jesus said to him, now this is just great, "What do you want me to do for you? Note, it's the same question that James and John asked, right? James and John came to Jesus and said, Jesus, we want you to do whatever we ask of you. Want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Right. They're saying, Jesus, we want you to write us a blank check. This time, it's reversed. Jesus says to Bartimaeus, Bart, here's a blank check. Right. What do you want me to do for you? Now again, we as the smart disciples who have read this James and John account say, oh, Jesus, do you know what kind of trouble you're in for? I mean, if you would have done that, I mean, if you would have asked James and John, they would have said, well, we want to be first. We want to sit at your right hand and at your left hand. We want all your glory. We want to be in charge and have control. But what does Bart say? Given all those possible answers, the blind man said to him, my teacher, let me see again. And again, this notion of sight for Mark, to read it at both levels, a sense of sight, a sense of insight. Right. To be able to see again is to be able to have that insight and that understanding of what's really going on in the world. And to have that insight and understanding, right? To see what's really going on in the world is to see and to understand how God is at work in the world in Christ, and how Christ is at work in the world through the cross. So Bartimaeus is asking for that understanding of discipleship. Again, hear that sense of mercy and seeing go together. And Jesus' response there, Jesus said to him, go, your faith has made you well. Immediately he regained his sight, and then note, and followed him on the way. Or in Greek, that sense for following, the force of that verb would be, and kept on following him. Right? I mean, that sense of, we've got another follower of Jesus, one who keeps on following. And note, right, the last three words there in the story, the way it ends, on the way. Or again, Exodus. Bartimaeus is the ideal of discipleship because Bartimaeus, again, hears and then speaks. Even when in conflict, told to shut up, speaks clearly. Knows what to say in terms of the understanding that what is needed is mercy, and that insight and understanding of how God's mercy is at work in the world, and then what? Keeps on following. Recognizes that the life of a follower of Jesus is an Exodus life. We are always on the way. And the thing there again is, and look at, all of this happens at the worst possible place with the worst possible candidate for discipleship. And yet here is the person who is the paradigm of discipleship. To follow Jesus is to be like Bartimaeus. Right? Bartimaeus reflects fruitful discipleship.
This may just be my naivete, but I'm curious as to why his profession of Jesus, son of David, and I mean he's referred to as son of Timaeus, how that is such a strong expression of faith. It doesn't, I mean, he doesn't call him Lord, he doesn't call him Master until the end, but he calls out to him by Son Up. And so I'm just confused as to how that expressed such strong faith or discipleship.
Okay, because again, within the context of that time, to talk about God's Messiah, God's specially anointed and appointed divine agent who would deliver Israel from Roman imperialism and everything else, there were all sorts of different titles that could be given to that Messiah. And they had slightly different nuances in meaning, but all of them were understood to be God's divine agent, God's Messiah. That could be like the Son of Man, who would be that final judge who would come. It could be the Son of David. It sometimes even was the Son of God, because earlier on, like in the Psalms, you have this understanding where the king is sometimes seen as Son of God, God's son, God's heir. So to cry out Son of David would be another title that would be like saying Messiah, Christ, God's special person. And that's why it's seen as a call of faith. Because you wouldn't just call anybody a Son of David. So, I mean, that to call, for this blind man to call Jesus Son of David is again a recognition that this man understands Jesus to be the Messiah. Any other questions, comments here about discipleship? In terms of that, what, that Bartimaeus keeps on following him on the way?
In other words, Mark is really trying to say, like you're saying, that Bartimaeus is sort of like the archetypal disciple, the good disciple.
Oh, I think my reading and understanding of Mark is that notion kept on following him on the way is very intentional. Because again, you see, this is precisely now the break between the second and the third major part of this gospel, right? And usually, right, literarily, when you come to the end of a major section, you're going to try to make a big point. So we're coming, right, the journey to Jerusalem now is over, right? Starting in chapter 11, it's the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, and we're now going to get into the last week. So this is the end of the journey section. So again, what was the point of the journey section? To again look at discipleship and what does it mean to keep on following Jesus on the way? So I think this phrasing that it ends with this last phrase, I think is very purposeful and intentional by Mark. Yeah, it is that sense of the Exodus thing, right? Put on your sandal. I mean, it's the kind of thing, Bart, get your sandals, get your staff, because just like the Israelites when they left Egypt and were on that Exodus way, you're on the Exodus way now. You've been visited by God, and it's time for the Exodus. Yeah. Okay.
I'm wondering what I've often been studying Mark kind of a little bit confused, as it seems like it's many times Peter and James, like you're saying, are sort of the examples of how not to be a disciple.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course he's the example of how to be a disciple. Mm-hmm. What is the Is this just examples, or what do you suppose the relationship is between them? Because then Bartimaeus doesn't really show up again, but these other disciples keep showing up.
Until they get it right, right? I mean, the stupid ones have to keep coming back. The smart ones can go out there on the Exodus, you know? But it's all the stupid ones that have to keep coming back, I think. Is part of, I think that's part of Mark's humor, but I think that's also part of Mark's message, right? In the struggle for discipleship, we always have to keep coming back again and again and again to be reoriented on this way of discipleship, on the Exodus way, because we just don't get it. And I think that's there. I mean, in that sense, Peter, James, and John are not great heroes of faith.
It seems that you're pointing out that this incident, this example, is the key example in Mark about the attitude and the posture you should have in discipleship. Mm-hmm. He picks the rabble of discards of society to show that attitude.
I mean that's right. I mean, again, you think in terms of a hierarchical model of society, you can't get much lower than being a blind beggar on the side of the road, right? So here we have one, right, physically handicapped, penniless, homeless. Right, I mean, in that sense, even this is the lowest class of street people around, if we want to put it in our term. And precisely there, right, kind of in, if you want to have a hierarchy of society or a pyramid, I mean, Bartimaeus is living in the basement of the pyramid. And that's the ideal of discipleship.
It's important to all the James and John and the other apostles and us, the same basic attitude.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Again, I think it's part of the radicality of what Mark wants to push and understand, right? That again, what we might consider to be the trash and refuse of society, for Mark holds out again the possibility that is where God is at work, bringing about abundant fruit. And again, that indictment on us, you know, people that we discard and discount and toss off so quickly, God does not. God finds them to be fruitful. And, right, to our shame, again, finds us to not be the fruitful ones. Right? We're the ones that don't get it. Why is it that we don't get it? Well, you know, back again to chapter 10, and this is all still part of chapter 10. One reason we might not get it is that we're into the authority power hang up, and that distracts us. Or the other reason we may not get it is because we're so busy trying to get rich that we're not going to get this, right? I mean, the rich young man is also part of chapter 10. Right? And right, there are two ways, again, that punning, there's two ways of being fruitful. Fruitful in worldly ways is having a lot of acquisitions and wealth. Fruitful in godly ways is acquiring and following Jesus and that life of faithfulness.
Bartimaeus is that live in our society today. I'm just thinking of the work I do in social services. If I don't give space to the people we're working with, who are in many cases the trash of the 20th century, we don't even give ourselves a chance to hear them or for them to relate to us. It's got to be a listening on both ends of the spectrum. In other words, the disciples tried to shut up Bartimaeus. We, by our structure and the way we do things at times, try to shut up the people that are around us.
Sure. I mean, that comes back again to that, even that authority. How are our structures built? How is our authority constructed in such a way right? That we don't have to say anything, that the rebukes already are there, that people know what we're telling them is, shut up, don't come here, stay away from us. And what a serious indictment. What a serious indictment and challenge.
To give people food in a food bag, it's easy. It's to qualify, you live in the area, and there's your food, you buy it.
Yeah, right. Right. I mean, this again, right? I mean, look at what this does to Bartimaeus, is it, right? To think about that, how within our own churches do we incorporate blind beggars as integral parts? How many blind beggars sit on our church councils? I mean, that's kind of the radicality Mark is asking us to think about. So, do you have any blind beggars on your church councils? How come? Why not?
Well, do they have to be on the church council? I mean, the apostles might compare to the church council, you know.
Yeah.
But the apostles have to give themselves the space to listen, to hear.
Sure. No, I only brought that up is because often from our structuring we think that if you're on church council, right, you're an integral part of the working of that church, of that congregation. And so I'm just saying, what are the ways in which we make blind beggars, however, right, or you know, those that we so easily disregard, what are the ways that we can be church so that these people are integral parts of what it is to be church? That's the challenge, again, that I think Mark gives us as disciples.
I think that we've been studying Mark all year, and one of the things that is really is missed in Mark, unless you're able to see the picture that Mark is painting. In other words, he paints in big stories, and I see this picture where Bartimaeus gets up, and now he's walking, and he's right next to Peter, and his sleeves are touching on Peter, and they're talking, and they're walking, and they're all together now. And that's really the picture, is that this is a group that they're arguing back and forth, they're talking to each other, they're wondering together, and it's not like Peter is able to go to Bartimaeus and say, you know, and keep thinking about him as some lesser person and all like that. It's Jesus has really proved to Peter and James and John that if it's any way, it's the opposite. That they better be listening to Bartimaeus because he's the example. I've noticed that so much with Mark that it's a lot of what Mark doesn't say, right, pointed out, it's the picture that he paints. Really very different than Matthew or John.
Unless Bartimaeus becomes a person by walking along the way.
I guess I'm just talking more in technical terms about narrative theology, which is that narrative theology says, look at the picture that's being painted, whereas most of us have been taught in Sunday school to look for these little phrases, like the teaching phrases, like those kind of things, whereas the pieces that are put together, and Michael's done so great at pointing all that out. But I noticed when we were doing this Bible study with Mark with farm workers in Arizona, that they were really able to latch on to Mark because it's a pictorial, the story tells it, rather than these, we're trained in the small catechism, which is sort of like doctrinal phrases, whereas this is pictorial theology in a way. I guess that makes sense.
Story theology.
Yeah, and it tells story, and so there are, right, and when you tell stories, think about, let's say, children's stories, right? I mean, often a key thing in children's stories is you repeat phrases over and over again, and they become important, and they keep the story moving, right? And they also finally are where the meaning is. Well, same with Mark. I mean, he just loves to repeat things over, right? Like, on the way, following, this kind of sense, right? Hearing, speaking, rebuking, and I mean, these words just come up again and again and again. And part of the difficulty for us, right? And it's not anyone's fault, right? But the kind of thing where if you can, you know, if you're lucky enough, quite frankly, right, to read it in the Greek, you see the same word is used all the time. And you don't have to be a great genius to say, well, if he uses the same word all the time in all these different stories, that must be an important word. That must be an important phrase. But in an English translation or whatever, for that translation to make sense, you maybe can't use the same word all the time. I mean, it just wouldn't translate into intelligible English. So you use different phrases. So it makes sense, but unfortunately, it also loses some of that key understanding, because there you don't see the same word all the time, so you don't catch it as easily to say, oh, well, if this is the same word all the time, boy, that must be important. I better go back and look at all those stories where that word is used to see what is Mark getting at here. Right? I mean, at least for me, that's one of the reasons that I still think it's important for, you know, pastors and other people who are going to be Bible study leaders to still kind of learn Greek and Hebrew, because it's important for theology. Right. For telling the story, not for just saying, oh, I know Greek. You want to hear me conjugate some verbs? Yes, please.
Is it possible that instead of meaning that Bartimaeus followed Jesus physically, that he simply followed his way of life and taught what Jesus was teaching, but he didn't necessarily join the group of disciples physically?
Could be.
Therefore, we never heard any more about it.
Yeah, I think that could be. I think for Mark, he puts all of those things together. And he's not worried about that. I mean, again, for him to be a follower, to be on the way, means that what? Bartimaeus is a follower of Jesus and knows what that means. And knowing what that means can be following on the way. And so we can, if you will, right, Mark ends the story there. But as we think about that for the meaning, we don't have to end the story there, right? We can now let our imagination and creativity go and to say, and what does following on the way mean? Well, it might mean that he just kept sitting by the side of the road on Jericho and kept telling that story to everybody else who passed by. And when they kept saying, shut up, Bart, he kept speaking all the more loudly. Or it could mean that he did get up and follow him on the way, and Bartimaeus and Peter are talking all the way into Jerusalem about what's going on and what this means and so on. And so, I mean, I think we can keep that story going in kind of different plots, but all of them would be appropriate in terms of helping us understand what following on the way is all about. I mean, again, the good thing about Mark is that he opens us up to see a whole bunch of possibilities of what following might now mean. It doesn't narrow it down and close us down. Okay, let's move on to the challenge. Chapters 13 and 14 in 15 minutes. Where we obviously won't be able to get at all of this, but there are certain things in there, again, certain key understandings that I would like to point out in chapters 13 and 14. Chapter 13 in Mark's Gospel has sometimes been called the Little Apocalypse. And And apocalypse is the Greek word for revelation. And so chapter 13, as the little revelation, is saying this is kind of like Mark's version of the book of Revelation, right? How the world is going to end and all of that kind of stuff. Yes, but Mark has a very different understanding about the end of the world, as we'll see briefly. And again, Mark's concern about the end of the world is concern about discipleship. All right. Unlike Hal Lindsey and others, Mark chapter 13 is not another version of the late great planet Earth and how it's all going to end and when it is going to end. Mark doesn't care about when. He cares a little bit about how, but not really. The thing here again, his concern is, well, you know, it's going to end. It's kind of ending all along. The concern is, what do disciples do? Knowing that the end is coming, that it is imminent, that we are already, according to Mark, living under or in end-time conditions, it doesn't make any difference when it's coming. What do disciples do in this situation? And that, again, is what Jesus' teaching about the end time is all about. What do disciples do? There's kind of three sections in chapter 13 about what this is all about. The first section would be verses 5 through 23. Maybe before that, we should look, verses 1 to 5. The key here again, in the Jesus comes out of the temple. One of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what large stones, what large buildings." Then Jesus asked him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." Right. In other words, again, you can see for Mark, the temple isn't what's important. It's not a sense of temple or place, space, all of that stuff. It's his Exodus model of discipleship, right? Don't put stock in the buildings, because the buildings will all come tumbling down. Right? Those kinds of institutions and edifices are not what discipleship is about. They will all come crashing down. And so if you put your hopes and dreams on those buildings and that, that'll all come crashing down as well. And again, then with the disciples here, Peter, James, John, and Andrew, ask him privately, "When will this be?" Right? They ask the when question, but you see, Jesus doesn't answer a when question. He very nicely at this point shifts the question to something else. And again, his first word there is what? "Beware that no one leads you astray." Beware. Or be alert. Or be discerning. That no one leads you astray. Right? And who are we concerned about here? Well, we're concerned about false Christs, right? Other folks who will be parading around as messiahs. False prophets, who again will be giving you false words and so on and so forth. And my word for them is predatory leaders. Why are these people false? Whether they're false Christ, false prophets, predatory leaders. And here again, the predatory leaders is in verse 9 and following. It's like, and again, this is always very indicting. One of the folks that, one group of people that often fall under predatory leaders are religious leaders. Right? Beware of religious leaders. Herod, Pilate are kind of the immediate folks in mind. But again, often beware of religious political leaders and what they're trying to do. What's the problem with these, if we would try to put this text together? Again, the problematic is that we see in these groups that they have a desire for power, authority, name, reputation, wealth. But they reject the word of God. They don't listen. And why not? Because they're not interested in listening. They're interested in power, authority, reputation, wealth, whatever. That's the reason that's there. You can see in verses 9 and following that, again, what Jesus says about the disciples, while they need to beware, basically is an outline of what happens to Jesus himself. As for yourselves, beware, for they will hand you over to councils, right? Jesus is handed over to the Jewish religious leaders' councils. Beat you in synagogues. You will stand before governors and kings because of me. Jesus stands before Pilate and Herod, right? So again, Mark's message to us is, well, if they did this to Jesus, certainly we as followers of this Jesus will have the same thing to have happen to us. Right? It will be no different. And so knowing that, right, that we can see here again, Jesus' words are words of comfort, even in this very tough, difficult time. And the reason for those words and those words of comfort, particularly verse 23 as we end it again, right? Be alert, I have already told you everything. The sense here, having been told everything, I think, gets us back down to that issue of, are we disciples that follow out of fear? Or are we disciples that follow out of faith? The reason that we may succumb to any of these groups would be because of fear. Now, to say, someone comes along and says, friends, you've heard what the Bible says. However, God has not told you everything. God has revealed to me the secrets of the end times. And for $79.95, you too can know the secrets of the end time. Right? You've heard those commercials before, right? I mean, and note, there's always, you know, like great cassettes and everything that go with it, of course. Right? Well, now, why would we be tempted to buy that? Even if, I do it just because I have this perverse sense of humor that I'm, right? But why would we even want to listen to that? You know, to say, why would people be so stupid to fall for that? Why are we such stupid disciples? Well, because it might be, well, maybe Jesus didn't tell us there. Yeah, you know, we don't know when it's going to end. I wonder if there's something else we need to hear. If we didn't get the whole story. You know, I'm kind of anxious about that. I'm uncertain. I'm not sure. I mean, these folks really know how to play on our fears, our anxieties, our uncertainties, don't they? And so we think, well, you know, $79.95 is really a small price to pay for absolute certainty, isn't it? I mean, for absolute certainty, I'll plop down $79.95. Of course, it's not going to be that, right? But right, it's a discipleship of fear that's coming through. And these folks prey on our fears. And predatory, right? I mean, obviously, these folks evoke fear in all of us because of the persecution and tribulation and conflict that can come. And so Jesus is saying again, be aware, be alert, be discerning. Don't succumb to fear. Faithful discipleship sees us through this. Living in faith surmounts those fears. Yes, Jesus has told us everything. We have the whole story. It is sufficient. We can remain and rely on those promises. We don't need anything else because there's nothing more to be said. So listen, right again, listen to what Jesus has already told us. And then there will be the clear speaking and the clear seeing and the clear living faithfully. We don't need to be in fear. That's the point. All of these things, you know, all of this end of the world stuff is stuff that's happening in the world right now. In that sense, Jesus is saying the end of the world isn't going to be any different than the middle of the world that you happen to find yourself in. This stuff is going on right now, and it'll always be going on. So, this is the key. What do you do as disciples when that goes on? All right, the second section, 24 to 27. Very briefly here, but I think it's important, is that this section of the coming of the Son of Man, right, that kind of apocalyptic judge, is very different than what we would have, for example, in Matthew's parable of the Last Judgment. Because here, there is no last judgment. There is no some go to heaven, some go to hell, if you will. For Jesus, the coming, the second coming again, the coming of the one called the Son of Man, is good news because it means the promise is fulfilled. Verse 26, then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. What's the final coming about? The gathering in of the elect. The good news that what? The promises that have been made are kept. We are delivered. We are redeemed. We are under God's promises. There's no mention here again of judgment, revenge, retribution. It's rather talk about protection and redemption. For Mark, that whole notion of divine punishment is unnecessary. We don't have to plunge the world into violence because it already is in violence. For Mark, his understanding is that evil ultimately destroys itself. Right? Because all these false Christs and prophets and these predatory leaders, I mean, because of their quest for power and authority and wealth and everything, they're just going to keep on killing each other till they kill one another off. Mark's understanding, if you want to kind of categorize it in this dramatic way, it says, well, if you want to talk about living in hell, look about you. Right? We do a very nice job of creating hells for ourselves. Right? I mean, God doesn't have to send us to hell. Evil in the world makes certain that it becomes a fact here, unfortunately. Right? So again, disciples, be alert. Right? Oppose those hellish situations. Oppose those situations that bring about evil and destruction and so on and so forth. And what is the end of the world about? Well, that's the good news of preservation, protection, redemption, deliverance. The end of hell, if you will, the end of that kind of destructiveness. We don't have to talk about punishment. Mark's not concerned about that. You can see here is one place where Mark has a very different theological perspective and understanding than, let's say, Matthew. Right, again, Matthew ends the parable of the last judgment with what? There's going to be weeping and gnashing of teeth. There's no weeping and gnashing of teeth here, right? It's a great, in a sense, it's a great celebration. As the elect are all gathered in. Right? It's, if you will, apocalyptic party time. Right? A time of rejoicing. Not of judgment. That's just Mark's perspective on this and what he wants to do. Again, knowing that, right, we live under the promise, verse 31, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. The words are always there. The words are always given. So if that's the case, what do disciples do? Listen. Be alert. Watch. All of that. And so, verse 35 again. All these words are put together, right? The conclusion. Therefore, keep awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight, or at cockcrow, or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all. Look at how all of a sudden this private conversation becomes public to all the readers, right? In that sense, Mark is saying, readers, same advice. Keep awake. And here, again, we're running out of time, but just to note how verses 35 through 37 set up the scene in the Garden of Gethsemane, right? The key here, what do you do as disciples? Keep awake, don't fall asleep. And you know the story, what did the disciples do in the Garden of Gethsemane? Fall asleep. They don't keep awake, right? So again, they just don't get it. Right? Even at Gethsemane, right, they still don't get it. They still can't keep awake. They're just stupid. But we're smart, right? We've gotten it here, and we'll see it at Gethsemane. So we will keep awake at Gethsemane. We will understand what's going on and what faithful discipleship means in that time of persecution and affliction and betrayal. Because we're smart disciples and we understand that following Jesus is the way of the cross and we can get through that. So we will get it. Maybe. Okay. Tomorrow we'll finish this up. By looking at Mark 16, the resurrection story, and what the resurrection story has to say about discipleship. So thank you for, if you want to stay for a few comments or that, I'll be happy to stay around, or I also understand why you want to go for coffee.
Thank you.
The Greek word translated as
"sleep"
is used throughout Mark is,
For which word?
You're saying there are
different words. I mean, it's the same word for following.
Okay.
The same word for on the way. It's the same word for rebuke. The same word for silent. So there's a whole kind of, if you will, almost a vocabulary list. There's several words, several themes that are used consistently, and because of that, you can say, oh, well, okay, he's trying to develop a consensus.
I was
thinking,
on the way, Exodus, that was one thing, but that's
right.
What you just clarified. clarified for me was that there are several.
There's several of those words, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And like in the Bartimaeus story, right, a whole bunch of those words come together, so you get that sense that, look, they're going to put all of those words into one story. Yeah, this must be an important story.
Exactly. And the way I tend to take things in when I read them too, is sensory and kinds of things, and just the way things are painted. So, but in John, how is it in John? I mean, I get the feeling like John is really reflective as well, but it's a different kind of, it's more like he's sitting under a tree or something, and he's, you know,
right.
Not really talking about details, but kind of expounding.
Right, John is a much more reflective, meditative, contemplative kind of gospel. That John has favorite words too, that he uses consistently. But he'll use one of those words, and then he'll go on for a whole chapter to tell a story, so you kind of get the sense of what they mean. Because, yeah, I mean, I think in that sense, John is, you know, kind of... Mark, it seems to me, is written so that, you know, you can tell the story. It's like Mark is a storyteller. You tell these stories and people can sit around in a circle and get it and talk about it and all of that. And it seems more like John is the kind of thing, like you would say. You would take John and find a nice spot under a shade tree and take a couple hours to read it and think about it and see what's going on. And if it's much more kind of...